I would this evening to challenge what I will call the false paradigm of peace. Paradigm is a set, as you know, is a set of ideas, set of assumptions, mainly, through which one understands a reality. And the paradigm of peace with regards to Israel and Palestine is set of assumptions about what is the essence of the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians, how should one interpret the reality today, and in many ways it's also a set of assumptions which forms the basis for a vision for the future. And there is a dominant paradigm about all these questions: how to understand the past, analyze the present, and look forward towards the future. And that paradigm is very powerful. It is very solid in many ways because it is supported by an incredible coalition of forces. Successive American administrations since 1967 support this paradigm. Most of the Western governments support this paradigm. Leaders of the Palestinian Liberation Organization support this paradigm. Almost all the political parties in Israel support this paradigm. Some of the most impressive and important moral voices in our time, one of them co-authored the book that we have on sale here, support this paradigm. So, you have to be a bit eccentric, as I am, to believe that you can challenge such a formidable coalition of forces. But I really think they're all wrong. Of course, they come to the paradigm from different perspectives. Some of them use it as a cynical tool to justify injustice. Some of them really believe that that's the only game in town. So I don't think they are all made of the same mold, but I think in the end of the day, they all support the same paradigm. And I think this is not just a false paradigm, it's a very dangerous paradigm. It's the paradigm of peace that allows occupation, colonization, and oppression to continue. And if that paradigm would still be dominant in the next decade, occupation, colonization, and dispossession will continue. The paradigm assumes that there is a national conflict in, or there is a conflict, I'm sorry, in Israel and Palestine between two national movements. And therefore, it also assumes that you have to respect these two national movements. You also have to accept that both of them are to be blamed for the conflict, and you have to satisfy them both. And the best political way of satisfying them both is to offer a two-state solution. That's one version of the paradigm. I'm sure there are others, but it's not that far away from everybody's understanding of what the paradigm is all about. The former Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, used to say in this regard that if you want to solve the Palestine problem, you have to look at everything which is visible and make it divisible in Palestine and Israel. So what is visible? Land, territory, population, resources, maybe even blame. And then she added, we have to avoid looking at the invisible, because the invisible is indivisible. By which I assume she meant the refugee problem, the Palestinians inside Israel, the issues of justice, the issues of colonization, and other issues which, before the Oslo Accord, were very high on the Palestinian national agenda, but somehow disappeared with the last phase in the attempt to impose the paradigm of the two-state solution on the area. Now, I understand very well why people under occupation would support the two-state solution, for instance. They would think that this is the best way to end a military occupation. And they thought that by supporting the two-state solution, they will see the back of the Israeli occupying forces. But they were wrong. In fact, supporting the two-state solution allowed the Israeli army to extend its presence and deepen its presence in the occupied territories. But the wish to end the occupation among occupied Palestinians is understandable. And yet, unintentionally, they lend their support by adopting this position to a false paradigm that would keep the military occupation forever. I can understand why my good friends like Noam Chomsky and Norman Finkelstein support the two-state solution as an idea that is, or their idea is that this is a realpolitik kind of position that they take. That if you take that position, you at least engage with what is possible, not with what is impossible. It's a bit like the divisible and the indivisible. Well, I'm made of different mold. I'm not interested in what is possible. I'm interested in what is just. And if the just is not possible, I will continue to work for it until it will become possible. But I think more than anything else, I find that among the great supporters of the paradigm, and especially among the people who genuinely believe that they are acting in the name of peace and justice and reconciliation, I think what is missing, and this is what I hope to do this evening, what is missing is a historical dimension. Maybe because I'm an historian, I tend to look for answers to a question like, how come such a paradigm is so powerful in history? And I repeat, it's a powerful, if the President of the United States and moral philosophers and Palestinian leaders and Israeli leaders support the same paradigm, it's a powerful paradigm. I think what they are missing, had they looked more thoroughly in history, they would find out that actually what they do by supporting this paradigm is supporting directly an old Zionist plan or an Israeli strategy, which is more important, of how to have most of Palestine without having most of the Palestinians in it. That, for me, is what the false paradigm is all about. And in order to answer that question historically, I go back to in time, and one should say to the credit of the Israeli state that it still offers us an easy access, or relative easy access, to documentations of the past. I hope they will continue to do it. It's very important for professional historians like myself to base our work on that kind of material. And recently they have opened the cabinet meetings between roughly 1965 to 1968, which for me is the formative period in which the false paradigm was conceived and born. And therefore I was very glad that I could go and check that formative period in order to understand how the false paradigm developed into a consensual peace plan in the eyes of so many good and important people. I go back to 1965 because in that year there was an event that most Israelis were not aware of that I think was very important for the conception of the false paradigm. It took place in Givat Ram, which is one of the two campuses that make the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. One campus is on Mount Scopus. It used to be there until 1948. Then it turned into no man's land, and then Israel rebuilt the Hebrew University campus on it in 1967. The other campus is built on the ruins of a Palestinian village called Sheikh al-Badr, which was ethnically cleansed in 1948. And the Israeli custodian of absentee property sold it to the Hebrew University for the awesome amount of money of one Palestinian pound, the equivalent of one Canadian dollar. Now, in that campus, which was quite, still today probably is, but definitely was in 65, a very beautiful campus, a very interesting group of Israelis met, or was rather invited by the Israeli military to convene. They were mostly the chiefs of the military rule inside Israel, which was imposed on the Palestinian minority in the state. Many of you may know that after the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, a small Palestinian minority was left in the country. They became known as the Israeli Arabs or the Arab Israelis. And they were subjected to military rule, quite a ruthless military rule, under British mandatory regulations, which lasted until 1966, some cases until 1967. Now, there was already a lot of pressure inside Israel to abolish this military rule. And the chiefs of the military rule assumed that they were called to discuss the end of the military rule, which in a way is true, but this was not the main reason that they were invited, together with some important legal minds in the country and other high officials of the Ministry of Interior of the Israeli government. What they were told is that it is true that the military rule over the Palestinians in Israel is about to end, but they should prepare themselves to transfer that military rule from one Palestinian group to another. And they were told that the next Palestinian group that would have to be administered militarily in the same way that the Palestinian minority was ruled are the Palestinians of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And mind you, this is 2 years before the June 1967 war. Now, they took a very interesting course. I won't go into all the details of what they learned or were supposed to learn. But what comes out, and that's the bottom line, is that they were prepared to run the affairs of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip as a military-occupied area, should they have to do it the next day. Of course, the next day, they did not occupy the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. It took another 2 years before they did this. They were waiting for the opportunity, and the opportunity was provided to them by Jamal Abdel Nasser, the Egyptian leader, in his not very wise brinkmanship policy, which did not work. Sometimes you do a brinkmanship policy and you walk on the abyss and you fall. Sometimes you succeed in surviving. He didn't. And that gave Israel the opportunity not only to occupy the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, as you know, but also the Golan Heights and the Sinai Peninsula. Now, what was decided in 1965 was how to run or how to maintain an occupation. What was not decided in 1965 was what would be the fate of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And that was left in the hands of the Israeli government immediately after the end of the June 67 war, around the 8th and 9th of June 1967. The 13th government of Israel made the decisions that would form the basis for what I call the false paradigm of peace. The decision they made was the cornerstone of all the Israeli policies until today, without any exception, towards the fate of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. To my mind, including the Oslo process. The Oslo process was also not a deviation from what the Israelis ministers have decided during the months of June 1967. There are two things I want to say about that government that I think is important. The 13th government of Israel was the most consensual government Israel ever had or would ever have. Every shade of the political map of Israel was represented in that government, from the extreme right to the extreme left, from the socialist to the capitalist, from the ultra-Orthodox to the most secular Jews. Everyone was represented around the oval table that or rectangular table, I don't remember anymore, that the cabinet was meeting. Actually, they were meeting around two kinds of tables. One in Givat Ram, where the prime minister's office is this ugly lump of cement that was built next to the lovely campus I was talking about. There was a rectangular table. And they used also to meet in the Knesset, in the Israeli parliament, around an oval table. Doesn't matter. The decisions were the same, whatever the shape of the table was. But I thought that since you made such an effort on a Saturday night, I'll give you some color. And this is my seventh lecture. I mean, I have to revive myself a bit as well. Anyway, putting furniture aside, it's important to understand that it was a consensual government because they understood, and they were justly thinking so, that they represented faithfully the Jewish-Israeli consensus. And that gave them force, that gave them impetus to decide what they decided. Second thing I want to say about that government is that half of the ministers in that government were generals in the 1948 war, or 1948 ethnic cleansing. And when they were generals in 1948, they were in their early 20s. Now they were in their early 40s or mid-40s, depends how old they were in 48. And during the 48 war, they formed a lobby, these young generals, that pressured David Ben-Gurion, the leader of Israel, to occupy the West Bank. Because they said to themselves, if we were so successful in occupying 80% of Palestine, why don't we complete the job and take the whole of Palestine and create a Jewish state between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean? And they pressured Ben-Gurion to take the decision, but he refused. He was 40 years older than they were. He was in the early 60s. And there were two reasons why he didn't agree to the occupation of the West Bank in 1948. Gaza was not so much on the cards. I don't want to offend anyone, but nobody was particularly interested then or today in the Gaza Strip. But don't take it personally if you are from the Gaza Strip. I like the Gaza Strip. I want it if you want to give it to me. But at that time, nobody was particularly interested in it, either in Israel or in Egypt or anywhere else. Now, the Ben-Gurion, there were two reasons why he did not accept this pressure. One was he had a tacit agreement with the Jordanians that in return for the annexation of the West Bank to Jordan in the 48 war, Jordan would limit its military participation in the military Arab military effort against the Jewish state. My colleague Avi Shleim has written a book about it called The Collusion Across the Jordan. Maybe some of you have read it. It's an excellent book. There's a book which is not less good about it by Ilan Pape called The Making of the Arab-Israeli Conflict. For some reason, in Amman, the Jordanian Mukhabarat have removed all my books and left Avi Shleim's book. He is more liked by the royal family. I don't know why, but I'll try and amend fences with the royals if I can in my next visit and convince them to return the books to the bookshops. But there is one bookshop where you can say that you want the books that do not exist and then they give it to you. In any case, this was one consideration, respecting the strategic alliance between Israel and Jordan, and the price was giving the West Bank to the Jordanians. The second reason was that Ben-Gurion was not sure that the Israeli army had the stamina to ethnically cleanse the West Bank as it did the rest of Palestine. This was a far more densely populated area. He didn't think that the Israeli army had the will or the capacity to do that as well, and he decided to leave that open. But this group of generals who became Israel's ministers in 67 have never given up the idea that it was a terrible mistake not to turn the West Bank into an integral, organic part of Israel. And now they were in government. Now they could decide it. And the two of them are very famous. One of them was the Minister of Defense, Moshe Dayan, who was a general in 1948, and the other one was Yigal Alon, who was a great hero of the 1948 war. And he ethnically cleansed the Galilee, but in 1967 he was a minister of labor and agriculture. He was not very interested in those two portfolios. He was much more interested in how to solve the problem of the West Bank. And together with Moshe Dayan, sometimes at loggerheads, sometimes together, they orientated the Israeli government policy on the West Bank. And they had to deal with a very weak prime minister, Levi Eshkol. So it wasn't much of a problem to decide what they decide. Now, according to the documents, they took three very important decisions, which I think quite a lot of Israelis are not aware of it, and definitely a lot of people around the world are not aware of it. Because the Israeli public continued to debate between itself whether it should withdraw from the territories or not, but the politicians were never part of that debate. The first decision that they took was that they would not ethnically cleanse the Palestinians from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. That they cannot repeat in 67 what they did in 1948. There were 1.5 million Palestinians. It's not that they didn't contemplate this idea, didn't play with the idea, but they thought that after the war, given the different kind of media you had in 67, there was already television, and given the Israeli army already demobilization, it was not a good idea to contemplate massive expulsions of Palestinians from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. It was not by mistake or accidental that they did contemplate it, because if you expel 1 million Palestinians, it doesn't make sense that you incorporate 1.5 million 19 years later. So there was a problem, a demographic problem for them. But they decided to leave them intact. There were here and there, as some of you know, massive expulsions, but not on the same scale as 1948, and definitely not as a result of a policy from above. The second decision that they have taken was that Israel could not exist without direct or indirect control over the West Bank. Again, the Gaza Strip did not fare in these discussions, but the West Bank did. There were two reasons that the ministers at the time gave for the need to keep either directly or indirectly the West Bank under Israeli control. One was strategic, and they again and again in the cabinet meeting described the Jordan River as the natural border of the Jewish state. And that's one of the reasons you want the West Bank, because you need a natural border. Now, I don't know how many of you have seen the Jordan River. The word river is a bit exaggerated. It's not even a creek, or maybe it's a creek on a good day. Now, even if you are 19 years old, you can still, and you're not exercising on a regular basis, you can still cross the river with one leap to the other side. But you can join the Israeli generals, some of them unfortunately quite obese these days, on the tours, and they will take the broken antenna from their car and point to the river and say, "This is the natural border. Here the tanks cannot cross. Here the F-16 cannot fly. Here the big Eastern Front cannot cross this natural border." Well, it's ridiculous, but... For example, Prime Minister Netanyahu is in love with this argument. He also has some sort of a sensual metaphor of the shape of the Israeli country as a lean woman that would not survive. He somehow prefers them to have... Yeah, anyway, okay, I'm going. That's the price of being on the road for too long. Now... But the strategic argument was basically that this is the kind of buffer zone between the Eastern Front and Israel. Of course, in 2012, this is ridiculous given how armies perform. But open the website of the Israeli Foreign Ministry and you will see these arguments are commodified all over the world. The second set of arguments to keep the West Bank inside Israel or as part of Israel was, of course, the ideological one, the biblical one. This is the ancient land of Israel. This is the heart of the ancient land of Israel. And like a person cannot exist without his or her heart, this is the same argument. As the years went by, the ideological argument became more important than the strategic one. There was an interesting idea that Dayan and Alon developed already in the very beginning of the second week of June 1967 about how to settle this idea that you want the West Bank, but you don't want directly to control it. Part of the problem was also that there was the United Nations pressure and American pressure to say at least that Israel is willing to withdraw from the territories in return for bilateral peace with Jordan and Egypt and Syria. So there was a pressure not to say directly and openly, although in the cabinet meetings they say it very openly that the West Bank is part, will ever always be part of Israel. But the outside world, it was not the right thing to say. Not even domestically to the Israeli public did they want to say that this is what they had in mind. So they had this idea that you can divide the West Bank into two West Banks, if you want. There's a Palestinian West Bank in the areas which are densely populated by Palestinians. There, the Palestinians can have an autonomy, or they will be connected to Jordan, depends on which part of the history we're talking about. But there, that could develop into, eventually, a state. This is the state in the two-state solution, this part of the West Bank. Then there is the West Bank that Israel needs to annex, where there are hardly any Palestinians. And there, Alon says already on the 9th or 10th of June of 67, we have to settle Jews there. That's the only way you can annex it, because you cannot annex it officially. You cannot announce, I'm annexing the West Bank. This will get you into trouble even with the Americans in 1967. Right? So you Judaize these areas instead of declaring that they are part of Israel. That was the tactic. So that was the kind of two divisions you had between the direct and indirect. The problem for the various Israeli governments was that there was also a new ideological movement emerged after 67, Gush Emunim, that had different ideas where they should settle or not. And they liked also to settle in the Palestinian or Arab West Bank. And the Israeli government and the settlers movement negotiated, still do negotiate, between which part would be the Palestinian West Bank and which part would be the Jewish West Bank. And as you know, as the years go by, the Jewish West Bank gets larger and larger and the Palestinian West Bank gets smaller and smaller. And yet, this is part of the powerful paradigm of two states and peace and so on. The third decision, which is very important, is the decision what to do with the people who live there. If you don't expel them and you want to keep the West Bank, what do you do with the people? So the Israelis invented something, which is called a citizenless citizens. It's like what you like in North America to do to the rest of the world with ideas such as Diet Coke and decaffeinated coffees, if this is really a possibility in life. But you believe in it, you should go on believing in it, that Diet Coke is Coke and that decaffeinated coffee is coffee. So stateless, citizenless citizens are citizens, according to this idea. But of course, the problem was not abstract or philosophical. The problem was in reality that if you maintain such a status of people for such a long period of time, you actually create a huge prison for 1.5 million people. And Israel built the biggest mega prison that ever seen in modern human history. In that prison, in 67, 1.5 million Palestinians were incarcerated. There are now 3.5 million in this prison. And these people are, there's already a fourth generation of the inmates, if you want, in that prison. And The prison becomes more and more prison-like as the years go by, because at first there was a lot of movement between the West Bank and outside the West Bank. Then suddenly the Israelis, not suddenly, sort of gradually the Israelis closed the gates, and the last thing they did before building a real wall around the prison was to say to Palestinians that they cannot get out of the West Bank through Ben-Gurion Airport. They can only go out through the bridges. So it really, I mean, the metaphor of prison becomes a reality as the years go by. And there were two models of the prison. And in these two models lies the false paradigm of peace. One model was the open prison model, where people were allowed autonomy, relative freedom. Even they were allowed to work outside the prison, provided they would go at night back to the prison. And they could eventually call the prison, or part of the prison, at least a state if they want to. But then if they resist the imposition of this model, they would be punished by being introduced to the maximum security prison. And the maximum security prison has collective punishments, the imprisonment of people without trial, demolition of houses, expulsion, the whole repertoire of Israeli collective punishment I'm sure you're familiar with. Maybe it's a good time to mention the 1,400 Palestinian prisoners who are on hunger strike and support their struggle for peace and justice. The maximum security prison was a retaliation against the 68 uprising, the 87 uprising, the 2000 uprising, and of course it may happen again. Now, as Tom knows, I like to leave a lot of time for questions, so I'm beginning to wrap things up. But before I do that, I want to say that what is important about this mega prison that I think is far better reality or a far better metaphor, in my eyes at least, than occupation or colonization even, is that in order to maintain such a prison, you need thousands of people to operate it. So the number of Israelis who were involved in this incarceration is huge. And there's already a third generation of wardens and jailers, as there is a third generation of inmates. And because the paradigm of peace created the illusion that you have on the ground a kind of a development towards peace, while actually it was the same story all over again of maintaining the prison, it would be very difficult to get out of this situation. Because what you need today in the relationship between Israelis and Palestinians, with particular focus on the West Bank, and of course you need similar solutions for the Israelis and the other Palestinian groups, but with particular focus on the West Bank, you don't need peace. You have to ask yourself, how in human history, were we able to turn a situation of wardens and prisoners into a situation of equality? This is far more difficult than peace. It's far more important than peace. This is more in the line of what was attempted in apartheid South Africa. This is more in the line of truth and reconciliation. But even that is not enough to my mind, because it's sort of taking and saying the prisoners and the wardens should be equal citizens. That would take a lot to create, and I'm hopeful. I think it is possible, despite the fact that there were three generations. But if we will continue to describe that reality as ripe for a two-state solution, we will go to the fourth and fifth generation of the mega prison of Palestine. That's why we have to get rid of this paradigm. I'm not saying that I know exactly which paradigm should replace it. I just know very well that this is the wrong paradigm. That doesn't mean that we won't have to work very hard to think of how then to reframe the relationship between Jews and Palestinians instead of the two-state solution or the paradigm that the West Bank is the future Palestine, or the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Even that is not on the cards as a future Palestine. And to do that, we have to do three things, and with this I will end. One, I think we should stop, and I say it to myself and I say it to everyone else who is either in a powerful or a less powerful position, I think we should stop believing and telling others that peace is around the corner, that the two-state solution is around the corner. I don't know where this corner is. Maybe in Vancouver, I don't know. I haven't checked Vancouver yet, but I've checked most places around the world. There is no two-state solution around any corner. Maybe on Mars there is a two-state solution around the corner. There is nothing around the corner. There isn't even a corner. And this created a false expectations among people and frustration. And I don't have to tell you that frustration produces violence. So if you want to mitigate violence, stop creating false assumptions and telling people that there is a kind of a reasonable, logical solution that is just around the corner. In the last sentence, none of the words I used is right. They're all false. The second thing I think we should do is not accept the basic logic of the false assumption, the false paradigm. The false paradigm says there will be peace, and then there will be an end of occupation, colonization, and whatever. No, it's the other way around. First of all, there will be an end of occupation, the end of colonization, the end of oppression, which, by the way, never ends just by negotiations. You need other means to end it. And then you can talk about peace. You cannot do it the other way around. And the third thing that we should do, and that is very important to my mind, is to at least avoid the demographic and geographical definitions of the false paradigm of peace. The false paradigms of peace assumes that Palestine is 20% of Palestine. We should not accept it. Palestine is 100% of Palestine. The second assumption is that Palestinians are only people who live in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. That's not true. That's only 50% of the Palestinians. Palestinians are also the people who live inside Israel, and they're also the refugees. And they're also people who live in exilic communities around the world. All of them are Palestinians, and any solution that would exclude them and ignore their wishes and aspirations is bound to fail. Thank you very much.